Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our special on the UFO encounter with occupants that happened in Socorro, New Mexico, April 24, 1964. This is the Socorro UFO story. This UFO encounter is one of the best documented ever, including some physical trace evidence that is available. In a minute, we'll be talking with Ray Stanford. He's the UFO investigator who covered the case from the beginning. But first, let's set the scene. It was 5:50 in the afternoon. Five people in an old Cadillac from Colorado were driving along in the wasteland near Socorro, New Mexico. The UFO almost took the roof off of the car as it headed toward what would later be determined a landing spot. And then they saw police officer Lonnie Zamora's car turn off the road and head up the slope in the direction of where the UFO went. They were there witnessing Zamora's frightening two encounters. And then the object's disappearance, it took off at supersonic speeds at 5:52 and 40 seconds. Ray Stanford is on the line with us from Maryland. He now lives there, where he's working on several scientific projects. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Let's talk about the key figure in the Zamora case, and that's Lonnie Zamora. And he has since passed on. But Ray really approached this thing typically as a police officer. And you might expand on that as we start the show about Lonnie Zamora, the key figure. If you don't mind.
Lonnie really didn't care. He never did care whether anybody believed him or not. He'd even rather have that it hadn't happened to himself. And, in fact, you know, if it wouldn't take a lot of persuasion, as I said in the eulogy I wrote for Lonnie, to convince me that actually when Lonnie read the account of what he had supposedly seen, he died laughing. And, that's the way Lonnie was. He just simply didn't care, but he knew very well what he saw. It's something he never wanted to see. He never believed in until, I think he never believed in it until he got right up to that thing within about, somewhere between 35 and 50 feet of the thing, and there was a roar and it began to take off. And then I think he began to seriously consider that the thing was an unidentified flying object. And thereafter, he even became suspicious sometime later when policeman Ted Jordan's film was not returned to him. He'd taken it right after the object had left, and Zamora and Chavez were there. Ted was the next to arrive, and he got photographs, and the Air Force wouldn't return them. They said that it was because film was irradiated. That made Lonnie suspicious that he had been involved in the case had been involved in a cover-up, Lonnie was not normally a suspicious person. It took that much to convince him that maybe this was something alien instead of a government secret.
Now, Ray, when we were putting together this show, this story, you and I had talked about quite a lot of the details, and evidently a lot of people came forward and told you things that are just out and out lies. You mentioned one woman who came to you there in Socorro and told you that she and her boyfriend were riding horses along the dirt tracks where the craft landed, and you're telling me that what she said was really just complete fiction. And furthermore, I guess you've got a good point. If they had been on horses watching it, when they listen to the show that we do about Socorro, they'll find out that this thing made a terrible noise. I mean, really loud when it first took off. It was a huge roar. I think she told you they just rolled off. You would think that he would have stopped and talked to Lonnie if that had happened, and he never mentioned it either, so you got a good point there. Anyway, you trusted Lonnie Zamora and his judgment, and you liked him. You had quite a relationship
with him. Well, I didn't have a lot of contact with Lonnie. We had such good and in-depth contact in the beginning that I knew how much he judged his own privacy, and I didn't pester him because I had answered all the questions, and they were relayed finally after, I guess it was, in 1976 when my book was published, and I promptly sent Lonnie a copy signed to him, and he very much appreciated it. Later, in fact, gave it to his daughter when she kept trying to get him to talk about it. For that reason, I didn't need to bother Lonnie. He didn't know anything more than what he had shared. I greatly respected his privacy. Of course, I didn't mention here that, his daughter wrote me, about the book and how much she appreciated what her father had said about it being the only person that got the facts accurately. I felt very close to him, but I'm a type that can be close to a person without clinging to them.
Ray, I think most of our listeners are probably not aware of it, but there's been quite a controversy going on about some of those symbols and whether or not they're real or fake. Isn't that right?
In the days ahead, I'm going to be releasing first a short paper that will show Captain Holder's the drawing that was made of the fake symbol, and it was actually signed by Lonnie Zamora. I will show it as it originally appeared, as it was actually made by the Army officer, the captain that drew it, and I will put beside it two examples of drawings that Zamora made that are of a totally different character. Zamora's presentation of this symbol is totally different from the fellow who drew it and told him to use it and refer to it as the real symbol. And I'll show that, and there will be no question in anybody who's observant's mind that the original symbol was drawn by the Army officer and not by Zamora himself. He simply was told to say that that's what had been on the side of the object.
Okay.
And secondly, later on, I may be releasing some photographic evidence relative to this case, one part of which will be the photographic case I had on the way back from Socorro on April 30th, west of Socorro, in daylight, of an object. I may be releasing that as well as some other photographic graphic evidence relative to the case that I think people will find quite interesting, but I'm going to leave that not described here, and it's a surprise, and Jerry, you can know that you will be receiving that as soon as I get it done up, in case you want to run it.
Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to Ray Stanford in detail about the Socorro UFO incident.
And we will talk to him about his investigation, and we will try to find out why he so firmly believes that this was a real event. One of the things we want to talk to Ray about when we come back with the rest of the show is the fact that there is evidently some trace evidence of this UFO landing back in 1964. Evidently, on April 29th of that year, Officer Zamora pointed out that it seemed that the Northwest landing gear had scraped a rock at its imprinted edge, and Ray did find metal landing gear scrapings there. What does it mean, after all these years, that all of a sudden this story at Socorro is being challenged, and challenged hard? A respected reporter is saying that the Socorro landing was a hoax. Witnesses have come forward, sorta, and Professor Colgate, who was the president of the college at the time, says that he remembers vaguely some students saying they did it, and he knows who they are, but he hasn't really named anyone. And Professor Colgate, he seems to have an interesting past. He's still around. He's up in Los Alamos. He's 84, and he spent most of his life working for the United States government, the Atomic Energy Commission, and other related agencies. So, could it really be true? Could a recognized scientist, Air Force investigators, and a respected UFO investigator be fooled? What about the shape of that strange craft in Sikora? It wasn't a disc, nor a triangle. Had there been other reports of UFOs shaped like this one, the one that they saw at Sikora, described by several witnesses? Stay tuned as the Sikora UFO story continues on the Jerry Pippin Show. Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual, on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com. The Sikora UFO story continues. Investigator Ray Stanford, who was on the scene within days of the reported UFO event, the landing, has written that when the object took off in front of Lonnie Zamora, it was so loud, it made police officer Zamora to the ground and assume a prone position, a reflection of his early training. Zamora said it did not sound like a jet, that it was very, very loud, even more like a roar. And then, after it had risen into the air, it took off at an unbelievable rate of speed, making little or no noise at all. Tony Braglia, a respected UFO investigative journalist, recently found a letter to Dr. Linus Pauling in the Pauling Library, in which, at the bottom of a letter to Pauling from a friend, a Dr. Colgate, who happened to be president of the college there in Sikora at the time of the UFO incident. This note said that Colgate thought it was a student prank. We tried to contact Dr. Colgate. He's 84 and now lives in Los Alamos. So he could tell us, in his own words, about why he thought it was a prank. But so far, we have been unsuccessful. We have been in contact with Braglia, who has told us that he has stopped doing UFO research for the moment and has returned to concentrate on his regular job. And I believe that's an executive search specialist. Dr. Don Burleson, who is the state MUFON director for New Mexico, told us in a recent interview about his scientific and mathematical conclusions about the UFO landing and takeoff. And if you haven't heard that interview, you can find it on our Angel Fire section of the website at iPodShows.net. In a recent email, Burleson wrote me, Braglio's latest information is still only amounting to somebody said somebody said somebody said somebody said that it was a hoax. And then Burleson goes on to say, and as for the supposedly coming out of the closet hoaxer, anybody could make claims like this after a half century. Why didn't he do this earlier? The articles by Braglio do not begin to address the mountains of evidence already on record, especially in the work of Ray Stanford, who wrote at book length and with great knowledge about the Sikora incident. The analysis of the metal scrapings, the testimony of the witnesses, the correlation of all the observed facts, the amateur student hoaxers would have to fool veteran military analysts about a flying object. Not likely. And then he signs it, cheers, Don Burleson. The professor mentioned Ray Stanford, and Ray has agreed to talk to us in detail about the Sikora UFO landing. Ray, once again, it's good to have you with us, and I hope everything is okay for you. Welcome back to the show.
I'm just all keyed up to talk about the Socorro case.
Ray, before we get into the Socorro case, I think we need to tell the audience a little bit about Ray Stanford. You have some pretty interesting projects underway.
Well, I'm working toward publication of some scientific papers, and I'm working two areas of science, Jerry. One is that I'm seriously involved in the research on dinosaur and other vertebrate tracks from what's called the early Cretaceous, in this case about 112 million years ago. To tell you the truth, I'm putting more time into my hard data UFO research and putting the continual touches, it seems like, on my PowerPoint presentation that I called anomalous aerial objects. I prefer that to UFOs, and then examining the physical properties with the instruments and methods of science, which presents the instrumented recordings that we have of UFOs, not only camera, not only, I'm talking about film, not digital, but I'm talking about recordings from magnetometer and gravimeter that we have used during actual events and were able to record the field. We can talk about now magnitude and the frequency of the fields and so forth. So it's very involved, but that's primarily what I'm working on, and it will, the public will finally hear from me on it. It will come out also in a book when I find a good agent that I feel is competent to handle something that should be taken seriously and is rather complex. Right.
I don't like to worry. 1964.
We've got what I call the dumbing of America.
You were a young man.
I expect America to be intelligent enough.
Okay.
And the world.
I hadn't had a birthday,
so I was 25 years old. In order to understand it. And
I was a young man too.
It's not simple.
How did you get involved in the Socorro thing in the first place? I mean, you were right out there right after it happened.
Well, an old friend of mine from Texas called me and said, Ray, I'm surprised you're there. Why aren't you over in Socorro, New Mexico? I said, I don't know anything about Socorro, New Mexico. And he had seen an article in the Houston or Corpus Christi paper that said, it was headlined, of all things, a long, tall object has hot feet. And I thought, well, of course, but then when he told me there was a police officer that seemed very credible, I packed up my little VW bug and my camera and recorder and headed towards Socorro from Phoenix, Arizona, where I was living at the time.
Well, you were in Phoenix, so you were fairly close, but it didn't take you long to get there at all, Ray. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit of how all this developed? Let's talk about
the time. It occurred beginning at about 5:50 p.m. It was a Friday anyway, April 24th, 1964, and I arrived in Socorro on the evening of the 28th, and then was able to, Dr. Hynek invited me, it was closed to the public, but Dr. Hynek invited me out to the landing site with him, Lonnie Zamora, the principal observer of the object, and the closest observer, and Sergeant Sam Chavez of the New Mexico State Police, and together we had a really wonderful session of Zamora going through and actually simulating everything that happened from the moment he stepped out of the car. And so it gave me a first-hand view of this that I don't think anyone except Hynek and I had, and I'm glad it was there. Hynek had gone without anything to take his samples for analysis for the Air Force, and I came with a briefcase full of 60 vials with ride-ownable surface, and a brand new vial that hadn't been used for anything, and so I shared them with him. In fact, I acted as a kind of a secretary. I labeled them for him as he called off the names, what he wanted me to say about each particular specimen he took, and also of the control specimens he took.
Ray, before Socorro, had you known J. Allen Hynek?
I had worked with Hynek only remotely.
Had you ever met him before?
Never had met him. I had extensive correspondence with him about a really wonderful and incredible UFO case involving what the layperson might consider a mothership and smaller objects in Corpus Christi, Texas, July 28, 1959. And in this case, we got two simultaneous color daylight movies, one with an 8mm camera and one with my 16mm camera. And Hynek, being with the Air Force as their consultant, was quite interested in this case, and I sent the film, or a first-generation copy of it, I forget which, to him for the Air Force, as well as the complete reports that we'd made on it. It was an unusual case, and Hynek was very pleased with that, because after the crowd in my parents' front yard where I was living back then, I was still in my teens, no, I was just 20, that's what it was, maybe 21, mm-hmm. we had kept the films unprocessed, and I contacted a UFO researcher, Max B. Miller, on the West Coast, and told him what had happened, sent him the film, and he had it processed in the lab with a photo technician he knew, and they were able to look at, examine, and make their own independent conclusions on the film before we ever saw it processed. My film turned out so good that, Jerry, if you ever watched the well-known series called In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy as host, mm-hmm. for over 10 years, that film was, when the program came on, you saw a blue sky with a white cloud drifting at the top and an object that looked like a piece of bone china shaped like about the proportions of a piece of chalk they might use on a drawing, chalkboard, and glowing, and you could see some motion, and it's a very beautiful film with a deep blue background because of the way I exposed it properly. So without my permission and never even being acknowledged as who took it, it was illicitly used by that production, by Alan Landsberg Productions, for more than 10 years. And so I happened in one day to see the show and saw it there and was pretty upset. And Hynek was involved very, very much. I had a lot of correspondence. Because this was unprecedented for not only two pictures, but in this case, two movies on entirely different size cameras and lenses to be recorded of object at the same time.
And exactly how did that come about? How did you get that?
It's quite strange. I was at home around noontime and in Texas in Corpus Christi.
Uh-huh.
And what happened was I got a call from a young man of high school age, Cecil Hansen. This was the summer, and he wasn't in school, and so he said, Ray, he said, you know, I think you ought to go out. He said, I'm going to run over to your house. He was only lived about 2 blocks away. He said, there's a little point of light high in the sky that you know, it's not a star. It's not. I don't know what it is, but it might be. He said, a mothership hovering up high. So I got out with my camera, and he came over, and we ended up with nine people. In our front yard, and including my father and everybody, their dog from down the street, and because once we saw this thing, I didn't know what it was. I called several people and said, you know, get over here. We want to show you this. We don't know if it's anything really important. Well, after I had watched this thing for 15, 20, 25 minutes, I realized that we were looking at the planet Venus, visible in daylight, because it was moving approximately 15 degrees westward due to the Earth's rotation. And however, fortunately, just as I was concluding this, a real UFO showed up. This was one of these tubular things.
Mm-hmm.
At first it looked like a glowing, an incandescent tube, except that it had a bluish glow to it, and very sharp-edged. And it hovered there, and we could at times see, and the lady with the binoculars saw much more frequently, small objects going to and from this, which the film confirms. And so then we were really excited. Unfortunately, I had used up a lot of my film on Venus before I figured out what it was. But finally, I got some wonderful film of it, and Cecil got even more because he had arrived late. And so we got the world's first simultaneous films of UFOs. And it was quite exciting. Four of these objects showed up. I don't know if they were the same one that would go up, disappear, and, you know, and another one, or if it was, you know, like either the same object or reappearances of this, what some people would call a mothership or a carrier object. But anyway, gave us plenty of chances. And furthermore, after I'd run out of film, but Don Chandler is still filming, a military jet approached it, and we have film of the military jet doing a reconnaissance run on it. And as we looked at the film closely, we can show that this object had an interaction with the jet. I don't want to try to go into it without having images to show people, but that object did something to the jet, and we didn't know this until the recent studies that I did once I had the ability to get into the film enlarged and look at the details. But you can imagine how the Air Force would be concerned about this, and because of how well documented it was, this had promise. Well, as Jacques Vallée said in one of his books, it was listed as unidentified in the Air Force files until the Air Force wrote everything that they could off when they so-called quit the UFO business, and they happened to see the mention, which Heineken actually put in there, that at first we were watching Venus, and then these objects actually showed up, and we got film of them. But they said, well, since Venus is mentioned, this has to be Venus. Disregard the fact that, as you would see if I showed you prints of the film, I could even send you images of it, Venus is a tiny dot in the sky. This thing subtended about 15 arc minutes in the sky, which is about half, a little larger than half, the angular size of a typical moon in the sky. So it was quite large, and it moved around and did things that the moon could not possibly do, and it released objects and apparently took on these objects. I mean, when they go into the glow around it, you don't know whether it's taking the moon, but you kind of presume that. So it was also the first documentation of the so-called carrier object with what NICAP used to call satellite objects, and believe me, we've got some darn good film of it. In fact, when Nimoy's film came out called In Search of UFOs, though they promised me to at least tell who took it and give proper information, friends that saw the movie, I didn't see it because I was so disgusted when I heard it was the best film by far in the movie, but they never told who took the films, and that I considered that very unfair. And then they went ahead and used it, you know, in Nimoy's whole series of films as TV shows as the backdrop. But anyway, that's how I got involved with Heineck. In fact, the first thing he did when he knew I was there in Socorro was profoundly apologize to me for his slowness in communicating about these things. Heineck was always a rather absent-minded person, and he apologized, but he would get absent-minded and wouldn't respond till months until I would send him a letter saying, Alan, what happened? So he knew I was patient, and he liked me because he knew that what I'd gone into to try to document this film, letting other people process it and analyze it before we ever saw the two films. So for that reason, I think he felt I was a credible researcher and invited me to come to the site, which was closed to the public. And I know I would have never gotten that much information and insight about this case if I hadn't been there with him and Zamora, because Zamora held nothing back when he was talking to Heineck and me. He was very open, unlike general contacts that he had where he seemed very reticent
Ray,
to talk about
it. In our preparation for the show and our emails back and forth, you mentioned that the fact that Zamora was patriotic, and to hear J. Allen Heineck represented the Air Force kind of opened the door, made him talk.
Yeah, I mean, he was a respecter of authority. Lonnie had spent time in the U.S. Army. And in fact, when he was in the Army, he heard a lot of tank hatches slam, and that immediately when the object just before the engine, or whatever you want to call it, had turned on with that blue column of light going down, seemingly knifing into the soil, he heard two powerful slams, and he said they were so heavy sounding that the only thing he could think of to compare them to were the sound of the hatch closing on a tank. And as you know, that's an armored lid, and it's very loud, and you can tell it.
So he could hear the hatch, so to speak, or the doors close as the thing took off in a hurry. What about the tourist or whoever these people were? There were witnesses, right? I mean, they saw this thing, and they saw Zamora.
Actually, the first thing that happened was that there was an old green Cadillac from Colorado. The woman, the man, the husband was driving, the woman was in the passenger seat, and there were three teenage boys in the back. And they saw an object come out of kind of the northeast, and it seemed to turn a little bit and come right over their car. The reason we know this is that soon after this happened, they made it to the north side of town to the Whiting Brothers service station. And Opal Grinder and his son were there. Opal Grinder was the owner. And as soon as, you know, he came to see, you know, if they wanted to fill up or what, this guy said, well, you know what, you've got some pilots, or a pilot flying an awfully strange aircraft around here. Well, Opal Grinder didn't know what he was talking about. And he explained, and the thing had literally, the family thought the roof of their car was going to be taken off. It was so low. Now this, as I said, had begun about 5:50, and Opal Grinder was told this within 5, maximum 10 minutes of when the Socorro event happened before it had ever been publicized. There's no possibility that these people heard about it on the radio and just wanted to claim they'd seen it. because they could not have heard about it at that point. Now, here's what happened after that. They went on north toward Whiting Brothers Service Station, but Zamora was following the speeder at a distance, so he couldn't be, so the speeder couldn't tell that he was there, recognized police car, and so at this point he saw the object that had come across the car, and it came over the area where it subsequently would land. There was a brilliant blue flame, and I have a note that indicates that Zamora saw something that was the object just before the flame turned on. But when the flame turned on, he got quite concerned. He didn't realize, he didn't believe in UFOs, and this thing really got to him. So about just right after the tourist, he had seen this, and then for about let's say about 30 seconds, the craft appeared to hover in that general area, and then it emitted a very brilliant flame, which quite a number of people saw and more heard. Zamora told a friend of mine, subsequently investigating this, about a woman, and gave him her name, that heard the roar, went outside, and actually saw the object in the process of descent. I, with Walter Schroeder of Radio KSRC in Socorro, interviewed two women that had heard it, but not really what it was. They didn't go outside, but they heard it land, and then they heard again, within a minute or so, the takeoff of the thing. So this was much better substantiated than most people have realized from the general accounts that have appeared. And Zamora finally, when he got up, what happened in his mind is he thought, well, there's a dynamite shack over there. I know that Holm Burson, the mayor, owns. I wonder if it's blown up. You know, what would shoot a flame into the sky? He didn't know if, you know, the silver thing he'd seen first might be a, you know, something like the lid blowing off of the thing. And so he took off over there, but he hit the gas a little hard, and his tires were spinning like crazy and making a lot of noise. But he said this thing was outstandingly loud. He said he could hear it over the rumble of his tires on all this gravel and rocks spinning under him being thrown up, and he realized he had to slow down a bit. Well, when he got to the top of the rise, he was looking at the object kind of from the end with the distant end of it kind of slanted up. So not believing in UFOs, he kind of thought, well, gosh, what is this? This is an overturned car, an overturned bus. It looked kind of whitish. And there was a 5-foot, 2-inch creosote bush right by what turned up was the location of the Northwest landing gear. And he saw standing right there. And he was able to size them up pretty well by the bush, which I stood there with him and Hynek and Chavez and measured, was 5'2". He said, he showed me where these figures came relative to the bush, and it would appear that they were about just slightly over 4 feet tall. And it's not disputable because he saw them right there by the bush, and we could measure the bush.